Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Welcome to the Apologetics.com radio program. I'll be hosting tonight, Christopher Niswonger. Unfortunately, our usual staff member, Lindsay Brooks, won't be with us tonight, but maybe he'll call in tomorrow later and harass us a bit. Now, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies declare the work of his hands. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There is this relationship between the things that God's created and who he is in and of himself. We sometimes call this the relationship between faith and reason. Well, tonight we're going to be talking about something a little different, a kind of an offshoot of that, which is the relationship between faith and science. Not only between faith and science, but the practical application of the understanding of this in our lives as Christians. And hopefully, we can get a little bit of a deeper understanding of it that will edify us. And for that, we have a special guest in the studio with us tonight, Leslie Wickman. How are you doing, Leslie?
I'm great, thanks.
Now, Leslie is getting one of our Apologetics.com awards for one of the most interesting Christians of the year, by the way.
That's true.
It's a little trophy. It only cost us $4. But also with us tonight, we have the CEO of Apologetics.com, Harry Edwards. Thanks for being here tonight, Harry.
Good morning, everyone.
Now, you guys go to church together, right?
Yes, we do.
That's right.
Yeah. What church is that, Harry?
It's Ocean View Baptist Church in San Pedro.
Yeah. So if you guys are down around San Pedro, the Torrance area, Long Beach, you might want to go by Ocean View Baptist. Do they have a website?
They do, and what is it? I'm not so sure.
It's something with Ocean View Baptist of San Pedro.
There you go. Just do a Google search.
Google search there, and you'll find it. Now, Leslie, we call this show the Astronaut Show, and the reason why is because, really, you're an astronaut.
Okay.
Now, you know, when we say that, you know, we're not joking. I mean, there are a lot of people that have a passion for the things that you've actually been doing. I mean, some of the things that as kids we used to dream about, you've actually gotten the opportunity to participate in. So you were a corporate astronaut. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, it was during the time that I was working for Lockheed Martin in Northern California. And when I hired in, they kind of asked me what I wanted to do. And it was just after I'd finished my master's degree in essentially rocket science from Stanford.
So you're a rocket scientist.
I am a rocket scientist. Hold the jokes for now, okay? But anyway, so I just started at Lockheed, and I was working on the Hubble Space Telescope program and the International Space Station program, and it was kind of a case of being in the right place at the right time, but they kind of asked me what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I said that I was very interested in human spaceflight projects and that I would love to fly in space someday. So I ended up working with the astronauts who were training for the Hubble Space Telescope deployment and repair missions, and I got scuba certified and worked in the neutral buoyancy tanks in support of the astronaut simulations, and then I got my pilot's license, and kind of as time went on, they liked what I was doing, and so I got spacesuit qualified and started participating as a test astronaut in the neutral buoyancy tests, and eventually flew on the Vomit Comet, the KC-135 research aircraft, which is aptly nicknamed the Vomit Comet. Don't want to go into too many of those stories.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, so ultimately I was designated as Lockheed's corporate astronaut.
Yeah, and what were some of the aspects of the training that you went through? I mean, we see a little of it in the movies and things like that.
Sure.
How intense is it?
Well, actually, I would describe it as more fun than intense. I guess, good. Maybe that tells you a little bit about my personality type. But, yeah, I mean, like I said, I went through the scuba training to participate in neutral buoyancy tests and high-altitude physiology training, which involved going in a hypobaric chamber and undergoing rapid decompression at a simulated altitude of 20,000 feet and going off of oxygen to kind of experience the first stages of hypoxia or low oxygen to the brain.
Yeah, I get that all the time.
Yeah, Chris, for some of us, we'd be dead by now.
But seriously, I mean, you have to be pretty strong physically to be able to deal with all of this and to be, you know, like a professional football player.
By the way.
Yeah. Well, what about that? I mean, also, you're a professional football player for the Quake, right?
Yes, yeah. I played for 6 seasons for the California Quake in Long Beach, and we won the Women's World Bowl the first season,
which
is pretty exciting. And, yeah, I played tight end, and, again, save the jokes. Plenty of jokes about that, too. But, yeah, we have a lot of fun. It really is a blast. It's NFL rules, full tackle, pads, you name it, so...
So in all of this experience that you've been through, you take it to a specific place as an educator.
Yeah, that's true.
So where are you at? Where do you teach?
Well, I'm the director for the Center for Research in Science at Azusa Pacific University, just up the road. And I teach, actually this fall I'm teaching astronomy. And I teach other physical science classes and some bio our life sciences classes as well. And, so I try to show my students as well as others, any other person who will talk to me, how science and faith go together.
So you're that girl that used to study in school, right? Is that the thing?
Yeah, I guess so. I was, yeah.
We actually have our first call tonight. Caller, you're on the air? Or we might not. So,
right.
But I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to talk to you at 1-888-LA-TALKS. That's 1-888-LA-TALKS. So I think what we should go into first, as a matter of due course, is your background. You might have grown up in a way that's similar to other people and just ended up in different places, but why don't you tell us where you come from?
Okay. Well, I grew up on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State in kind of a very isolated community right along the north edge of the peninsula, overlooking Vancouver Island. And because it was kind of isolated, we tended to have to entertain ourselves, which involved a lot of outdoor activity and playing with the neighborhood kids and building forts and riding bikes and, you know, playing on the beach and even swimming in the 43-degree water right off the coast there.
Oh, wow.
You didn't know any better. It wasn't too bad once you kind of got numb. But anyway, my dad had a telescope when we were kids, and we used to look at the stars and the planets and the moon, and that was probably the first time I really got interested in space. And I grew up in a Christian home, and but went through secular schools from the time I was in first grade through 12th and then on into college. But always was told that, you know, in my science classes, I might as well just kind of leave my faith at the door because it had nothing to do with what we'd be talking about in the science classroom, which I always thought was kind of strange because I felt that, you know, if God is who he claims to be, that studying his creation would only reveal more about him. And so there had to be a way to reconcile it, even though I wasn't learning that from any of my teachers.
Right.
So that's kind of my general background as far as growing up.
Okay, caller, you're on the air with apologetics.com. Do you have a question or a comment for Leslie Wickman?
Hi, good evening. Yes, a quick question. And hi, Leslie. You answered it a little bit, but I'd like you to answer it a little more. I was thinking it's just very interesting and exciting that you're an astronaut, and it sounds like a wonderful thing to do. But I wonder, where was the desire born? I mean, I think most little girls want to be ballerinas and actresses and singers, and maybe one of them wants to be a firefighter. But an astronaut, it just sounds pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I guess I was always a little bit of a tomboy, and I don't mean that in the sexist sense, but I was definitely an outdoors kind of gal, and always real sporty. And I guess what I was, what kind of brought it together for me in terms of wanting to be an astronaut was looking for something where I could use both my intellectual curiosity about creation as well as my interest in being physically active and doing fun stuff and adventurous stuff. So I've always been really kind of a thrill seeker, if you will, and very adventurous at heart.
Now, also with that, you said your family was Christian.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And they still at least gave you the opportunity to really pursue intellectual interests.
Absolutely.
You know? Because we always hear about, you know, Christian families that don't allow their children or don't want their children to excel in understanding the world, understanding the sciences. I tend to think that's a little bit of a straw man. Christian families do. Actually.
Absolutely, yeah. And my dad was an engineer, and,
yeah.
You know, I think it was partly due to him that I kind of, at least inherited my abilities in math and science and had a good, strong role model there. So, and my mom, too, she was a dietitian. And so, in terms of kind of the life sciences side.
So, you just come from a really brainy family? Is it? Hey, it can't hurt.
Well,
right?
Sure, exactly.
Caller, did that help at all?
Yes, thank
you. Did
you
have any follow up?
No, that was it. I always wondered, you know, if it always had to do with her face somehow or, you know, how. But, yes, it does answer for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And anybody else who wants to call right away because we've got lines open here at 1-888-LA-TALKS. That's 1-888-LA-TALKS, and we want to hear from you if you have questions for Leslie Wickman. In that, when you got into college, things must have gotten even more hostile. If people were confronting you with different aspects of your faith when you were in high school or when you were in elementary school, it must have only intensified when you got to, you know, college.
Well, yeah, although I took a little bit of a circuitous path in terms of my education. I started out as an undergrad majoring in political science.
Oh, yeah.
And I was kind of on a track to get into international relations. And actually, once I graduated in political science, I did an internship at the State Department at the Soviet desk. And very quickly realized that I needed to have an advanced degree to get anywhere with that. And so I wrote some letters and talked to some people and corresponded with then Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger.
Wow.
And he kind of encouraged me, too, to get a degree in a technical field. And so at that point, I went back to grad school in, again, like I said, rocket science. I got my master's in aero-astro engineering and then went off in the more technical and science direction. But you're right. Once I got into science at that level in grad school, and even in working in the aerospace industry, I came into situations all the time where people were just of the opinion that science and faith just didn't mix.
Wow. We've got another caller on the line for Leslie Wickman. Do you have a comment or a question?
Hey, it's Lindsay Brooks calling.
Hey, Lindsay.
How are you, my friend?
Good. That wasn't even planned, huh?
No, it totally wasn't.
Man, you are on time.
Well, I was listening to Leslie Wickman thinking to myself, what an incredible woman. What a role model for...
Lindsay has two daughters, by the way.
Oh, fantastic.
Two daughters. You know, just spent the last hour or so on the phone with my oldest up at UC Berkeley. Go Bears!
Ooh. Cardinal.
Well, you know, nobody's perfect. You know, I was, you know, amazed because, you know, my daughter and I were talking about, you know, some of the just assaults on the faith that come from, you know, being in a secular institution and how is it that Christians hang on to their faith, survive the secular institution experience and still, you know, come out thinking straight.
Mm-hmm.
And You know, it is a challenge, and but I was curious from your perspective, what was it like for you, being a Christian, coming into rocket science and trying to get, you know, trying to get out of that with your faith intact?
Oh, those are good questions. I think, again, for me, I was seeing around me people that, that especially in engineering, that kind of seemed to just assume that the researchers and the scientists who were kind of into origins research had all the answers, and that the engineers had were kind of taking it for granted that the people that were doing the research had answers as to how naturalism could explain how this all came to be. But they weren't really looking into it for themselves. They were just making some assumptions. And so, you know, like I said, all along I kind of had this kind of unease about what I was being told, that, and I just knew that there had to be a reconciliation. And one of the things that happened for me that was really kind of a milestone was reading Philip Johnson's book, Darwin on Trial. And that kind of opened the door for me to kind of start my own exploration of these issues. And once I started looking, the more I realized that there was just overwhelming evidence that there had to be a creator.
Now, Leslie, you did mention a term that we use a lot around here, naturalism. Maybe you could explain a little to our audience about what naturalism is.
Okay. Well, the idea of naturalism is that they're purely natural explanations, physical explanations for one's worldview and how everything came to be, the origins of the universe, the origins of life, etc., have purely natural causes. And again, that's a worldview. That's why it's an ism, if you will. It's a belief system.
Right, right.
I find, you know, closely tied with naturalism is this notion of complexity, you know, and sort of what makes humanity the crown jewel of at least the ecosystem on Earth is the amazing complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And part and parcel with that is this notion that by natural forces we can really experience an increase in complexity. And do you find that that's true, sort of, it's an axiom almost that has to be held in order for us to view ourselves as, you know, evolved beings in that sense? Do you find complexity, you know, is something that explains our physical universe or increasing complexity by natural causes?
Well, I think increasing complexity really violates the second law of thermodynamics, which says that entropy increases or chaos increases, disorder increases within a closed system. And the way you'll see that naturalists kind of trying to explain that away is saying, well, as complexity and order increase in living systems such as humans, that the entropy is offset by an increase in disorder elsewhere. And that, to me, is really kind of stretching to try to come up with an explanation for how you see the increase of complexity in living systems.
So in other words, it's sort of like, you know, squeezing a water balloon, you know, where one side increases in volume, complexity in this case is, you know, the factor that we're trying to increase by.
Mm-hmm.
The part that you're squeezing on sort of decreases, you know, proportionately. Is that kind of an accurate?
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Although, you know, squeezing a water balloon is a lot more simplistic than squeezing the evolutionary tree, if you will, and producing a human.
Now, what is the second law of thermodynamics, and what is entropy?
Okay. Entropy is simply chaos or disorder. Okay, and the second law of thermodynamics says that the amount of entropy or disorder in a closed system that is unaffected by outside forces will always remain the same or increase, never decrease without applying additional energy
Now, why would that tend to imply something about intelligence or design in what we find ourselves to be?
Well, because of the, I mean, if you look for purely natural causes to go from an amoeba, if you will, or one-celled living system,
sure,
to more complex creatures, the complexity increases dramatically.
Wow.
And so in order to get that increase in complexity, you're actually going against entropy. Basically, you're going from less order to greater order, which is exactly the opposite of what the second law of thermodynamics said would happen if things are left to themselves.
Right.
So you have to have some source for this new information and greater complexity happening over time.
Lindsay?
So even in a, before we even get to the point of life, we have to have some sort of increase in complexity.
Exactly.
To get us, sort of to the precipice of life.
Exactly, exactly.
One scientist recently said that it piggybacked on crystals. I don't even know really what that means. But do you find that you're a rocket science, you put complex machinery together. Have you experienced sort of machines that assemble themselves by naturalistic causes? Or, are there examples of that? Or is this something that's sort of in the realm of fantasy?
Yeah, that's still pretty fantastic, I'd say. It's the whole idea of, I keep coming back to the second law of thermodynamics, and that you're just not going to get an increase in orderliness and information unless you apply some organizing factor to it from the outside. The system itself is not going to be able to produce that under natural physical laws. In fact, it was interesting what you were saying about in terms of just getting the chemicals together for a living cell. In fact, Sir Fred Hoyle, who was a self-proclaimed atheist, said that the likelihood of just getting the right enzymes together for life, or something like 1 in 10^40,000th power.
Now, Fred Hoyle was one of those gentlemen, though, that worked in the sciences and philosophy for many decades, but had a change of heart later in his life, right, about some of these issues?
Well, he talked about intelligence and whatnot. I'm not aware that he ever...
He even had some arguments against Darwin's version of natural selection and evolution at some time.
Okay, but I'm not familiar with Sir Fred Hoyle's. I don't know that he ever converted from atheism. Sir Anthony Flew did recently.
Sure, right.
And he's kind of been in the news. In fact, has said that the intelligent design movement was instrumental in his conversion from atheism.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, now in this, there's an idea called the anthropic principle. Maybe you can tell some of our listeners what that's about.
Okay. The anthropic principle is one of my favorite apologetics tools, actually.
Oh, great.
I've been known to talk to people on the chairlift while skiing. They probably wish they could jump at some point. But anyway, the anthropic principle is the observation that has been made and is very well accepted throughout the scientific community, particularly in astronomy and astrophysics, that there is a very long and growing list of universal parameters that appear to be very finely tuned within a narrow range of values to allow for life to exist in the universe. These are things like the speed of light, the universal gravitational constant, the electromagnetic force, the mass ratio of various subatomic particles to each other, the expansion rate of the universe, the mass density of the universe, etc., etc. Anyway, depending on who you talk to, some people will say that this list of parameters is dozens long. Others will say it's hundreds long. But in any case, if you start looking at the probability of all these things being just exactly fine-tuned within the range that they need to be in order to allow life to exist anywhere in the universe, you very quickly come to realize that the probabilities are just remote. In fact, by some calculations, if you look at a list of hundreds of these parameters, several hundred of these parameters, the odds are something like 1 in 10 to the 282nd power.
And okay, if you had to choose your favorite parameters, because 100 would take a long time.
Yeah.
If you had to talk about, say, 4 or 5 that you find very convincing or interesting, what would they be?
Okay. Well, definitely one would be the expansion rate of the universe, which is actually tied very closely with the mass density of the universe.
Wow.
So if we look at that just for example, if the expansion rate of the universe were any faster, you would never get, it would expand too fast to have any kind of gravitational clumping and matter coming together to form stars or galaxies or planets. If the expansion rate were faster, none of that would happen. Everything would be accelerating away from each other so fast that you'd never get the formation of stars, planets, or galaxies.
Right.
If the expansion rate were slower, gravitational attraction between the masses would have collapsed the universe back on itself. So there's one very basic parameter. The strong nuclear force is another one that's one of my favorites to talk about. And the strong nuclear force is the force that holds all the nucleons or particles of the nucleus of an atom together, all the protons and neutrons. So as we all know from grade school, the electromagnetic force causes like-charged particles, such as protons that are positively charged, to repel each other. If you think about it, the nucleus of any atom, other than hydrogen, has more than one proton in it. So the strong nuclear force is capable of overcoming those electromagnetic repulsive forces and holding those particles together in the nucleus of an atom.
Wow.
So if this, I don't know if you want to go into the details here, but the strong nuclear force is strong enough to overcome those forces. If the strong nuclear force were any weaker,
right,
we wouldn't be able to have any atoms other than hydrogen.
And tonight we're talking with astronaut, scientist, educator, Leslie Wickman. We're going to be talking about a lot of different scientific ideas, the relationship between science and faith, between faith and reason. You're listening to the Apologetics.com radio show, and we'll be right back.
Is your future financially secure? If you're not sure how to answer that question, then chances are you need to take steps now to plan for your upcoming retirement. When it comes to a lack of savings, often it's not a question of low income, but a matter of high spending. My name is Pete Mitchell, and I'm a member of the board of directors for Apologetics.com, and I also specialize in financial and retirement planning for Christians. I'll be happy to send you a copy of my top 10 retirement blunders and how to avoid them to help you get started. It details 10 simple ways you can work towards increasing your retirement. Make a plan for your future today. Call me at 877-777-5047 for your complimentary copy. That's 877-777-5047, or visit my website at PeteMitchellInc.com. Investment advice offered through Capital Republic Financial Group, a registered investment advisor.
Hello, this is John Snyder, staff member of Apologetics.com. If you're interested in making the best argument in behalf of the things that you believe, if you have a heart to engage the culture and fight the good fight, I'd like you to consider an excellent program that trains up minds and hearts to be advocates of the truth. Trinity Graduate School of Santa Ana, California offers unique graduate programs in bioethics, public policy, international law, and communications and culture. Formerly the Simon Greenleaf School of Apologetics, Trinity Graduate School will train you to engage the culture in the marketplace of ideas that the modern secular world is unable to answer. Christians must have a cogent, clear, and compelling voice in the public square. If you're interested in such a program and acquiring such a mind and such a voice, I encourage you to contact Trinity Graduate School and speak with a representative. You can contact Trinity Graduate School at 1-800-395-0499. That's 1-800-395-0499. Trinity Graduate School, Santa Ana, is a satellite campus of Trinity International University with campuses in Deerfield, Illinois, and Miami, and has the highest reputation in the world of academics. Again, you can contact the Trinity Graduate Program at 1-800-395-0499. Trinity Graduate School, forming students to transform the world through Christ.
And welcome back. You're listening to Apologetics.com, 99.5 KKLA. Second segment of this hour, and we still have another hour to go. A very good show this morning. We have in studio Christopher Niswanger. Lindsay Brooks is on the phone. Harry is in studio. And our special guest, Leslie Wickman, is here as well. And you want to listen in and meet this woman. She is really, really an incredible woman. And you're going to hear all about her, so keep it right here at 99.5 KKLA. Let's get going now. I want to give out the numbers to you once again. 888-LA-TALKS. That's 1-888-LA-TALKS. 1-888-528-2557. Reach us via the internet at radio@apologetics.com. Challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe. It's apologetics.com on 99.5 KKLA.
Curtis has given me grief because this is the theme from Star Wars. You know? Isn't this the part where, like, Princess Leia comes out at the end and stuff like this? Well, we're doing the astronaut show tonight, and our guest is Leslie Wickman. Thank you so much for being here. Should we call you Dr. Wickman?
Please.
Or Dr. Leslie?
Please don't.
And we have Dr. Harry Harry Edwards.
Just call me Harry.
How's it going, Harry? Lindsay, you're on, right? Are you on there somewhere, Lindsay? Lindsay's calling in from our satellite out in space, I think, so he can't get through right now. But what we're doing is we're talking about a lot of different things and the relationship between faith and science, faith and reason. And when we went to the last break, we were talking about the anthropic principle. Maybe you can tell us what that is again, and then we can get into the strong nuclear force, okay. The weak nuclear force.
Great. Sounds good. The anthropic principle is the observation that's commonly accepted throughout the astronomy and astrophysics community. That is the observation that there's a very long and growing list of universal parameters that have to be finely tuned within a very narrow range of values in order for life to exist, not just on Earth, but anywhere in the universe.
Wow.
Yeah, and so if you start looking at these parameters and the likelihood of them lining up just exactly right within these narrow ranges, you very quickly realize that the odds are stacked against all of this just happening by random chance.
So the universe.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Because one of the objections I often hear when I present the anthropic principle is, well, you know, of course these things are going to be lined up just perfectly for us because we're here. Hmm. You know, they feel like it's sort of a backwards argument. The naturalist would say, you know, it's because things are sort of lined up in this way that life could exist, and that's true, but why is that necessarily significant in terms of indicating a designer?
Well, the most obvious and I think most accessible reason for why that's interesting is that this is a pretty special result for us to be here, for intelligent beings that can appreciate the fact of what it takes for us to be here and to think about it and contemplate it is a pretty special result. So, you know, you talk about, well, what does that mean? What is special? And again, it gets back to what is information, what is complexity as a result, or as compared to just chaos and randomness. So anyway, I think that's, you know, something that people have to acknowledge and try to explain at least. The other objection that we hear to this, which is probably the most frequently used counter-argument of a naturalist to the complexity and order that we see in the anthropic principle, is the multiverse hypothesis.
Right, right. There was actually a in Ben Stein's movie, there was an illustration of this, which I found to be pretty compelling.
Right, yeah. And so the idea of the multiverse hypothesis is that there are perhaps an infinite number of other universes, all of which have different values for these various parameters, and ours is the only one that just happened to get them all right. Of course, that begs the question of, well, how do we investigate whether or not there are these alternate universes? That's something that we, by definition, have no access to in other universes.
Yeah. Sheer fantasy. There's other universes that anyone has ever observed any evidence of.
Right.
Oh, I've seen a few. Okay, maybe not. Well, now, when we talk about the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, electromagnetism, and gravity, mm-hmm. those four forces, maybe you can try to just communicate a little to people like myself, you know, the lay person, what they are and why they matter in this kind of a discussion about the existence of God and order, creation,
okay.
design.
Okay. Well, let's just start with the strong nuclear force. And as I was starting to say before, the strong nuclear force is the force that holds all the nucleons in the nucleus of an atom together, the neutrons and the protons, overcoming the electromagnetic repulsion between the protons. And interestingly, the strong nuclear force is the strongest force known of, but it's only good for, coincidentally or conveniently, the providentially is a better word,
yeah.
probably, the average diameter of the average nucleus of an atom. So so it's only good for that distance, and unlike gravity, it doesn't taper off, but it goes immediately to zero beyond that very small distance.
That's
of
amazing.
The average. Isn't it?
Yeah.
What a coinkydink. So anyway, but imagine that the strong nuclear force were not limited that way and were good for longer distances or tapered off like gravity does. Well, then all the subatomic particles in the universe would be stuck together in one gigantic glob.
Hmm.
Okay. On the other hand, if it were any weaker, it wouldn't be able to overcome the electromagnetic repulsion of the protons, and you couldn't have any atoms that were more complex than hydrogen with just one proton.
Oh, wow.
So, again, here's another example of fine-tuning with the strong nuclear force. Another one, let's just jump to gravity, shall we, for a second, in terms of the strength of gravity. And something that I find very useful in the classroom is talking about, you know, bringing that concept down to Earth, if you will. Earth's gravity is...
Bringing gravity down to Earth?
Sorry.
I was going to say something, but I thought I better not interrupt you.
You knew I would if you didn't, Lindsay.
No
I can always count on you, Chris.
Yeah, I see how this is going. Anyway, but Earth's gravity is finely tuned, if you will, to be just barely strong enough to hold on to water vapor, which we absolutely need in our atmosphere in order to have a water cycle that waters the earth and purifies water. You need to be able to have water exist in all three physical states. You have to have the ability for liquid water, frozen water, and gaseous water vapor to exist on a planet in order to have a water cycle that will water the planet and purify the water as a part of the evaporation and condensation. So Earth's gravity is just barely strong enough to hold on to water vapor, which weighs 18 grams per mole, and not quite strong enough to hold on to either methane and ammonia, which in contrast weigh 16 and 17 grams per mole. So if you imagine that finely tuned difference in the gravity, where we can hold on to the life-giving water vapor but not hold on to methane and ammonia in large quantities, which would be poisonous and essentially detrimental to life. Just that one fact alone is just amazing.
So not only the parameters for our existence in the form that we find ourselves, but also for our continued life.
Exactly.
In the place that we are, is very fragile.
Exactly.
You know, it couldn't have been too many other ways or we wouldn't
exactly
be here.
We're balanced on a knife edge.
It's kind of spooky.
Yeah, it is.
If that's true, you know, is there life on Mars?
Well, that's a question we're going to get into a little later, Lindsay.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm jumping the gun.
No. I mean, it's a very interesting question.
I can't wait to talk about that.
In that, there's this idea called the unified field.
Grand unified theory?
Yeah, the grand unified theory that's supposed to tie all of these together. Are we any closer to understanding that than we used to be? Are we ever going to find that thing?
Well, according to Stephen Hawking, no. So one of the most brilliant minds of our day doesn't seem to think that we'll ever get to that. But, you know, I mean, it's a worthy goal, I think, to come up with something that ties all these different theories together. I mean, for example, I mean, just you look at the kind of progress of science through the ages, and you see kind of one paradigm shift after another. And, you know, in moving from Newtonian physics and a Newtonian explanation of what gravity is to Einstein's relativity and an entirely different understanding of what gravity is. And when Newton looked at or experienced the apple falling on his head, the proverbial apple that fell on his head, and said, aha, you know, the force that is causing this apple to fall to the ground is the same one that holds the moon in orbit around the Earth. I mean, that was a pretty profound jump, if you will.
It is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Even when he was describing gravity, he wasn't able to explain why gravity works or why masses attract each other.
Right.
It was really just a description of that force, and people thought it was so mysterious that these two masses could attract each other, especially at a distance.
Hmm.
You know, the moon is so far away from the Earth, how could those two masses have any effect on each other? And similarly, the Earth and the Sun, etc. They thought it was kind of spooky, but it was just simply a description of how those forces work. But then when Einstein came along with relativity theory, explained, you know, how masses bend the very space-time continuum and cause gravity wells around large objects that cause other objects to kind of fall into these gravity wells around larger bodies, which explains the way that gravity works. I mean, that's really a paradigm shift.
Right. So you go from having an idea like that all two particles in the universe attract each other equal to the mass times the distance to the fact that things are moving through the curvature of space based upon their mass, which is a very different way of looking at the same thing.
Right.
It's almost like a completely different understanding of the same thing.
Right. And it's relativity theory kind of explains how gravity works.
Wow.
Rather than just being a kind of a brute description.
Yeah, but Harry, you had something that came to mind.
Yeah, you know, Leslie, you were talking about your love of science in the very beginning, and how when you were a child growing up, you were encountering your teachers saying that if you're going to learn science, you kind of need to leave your faith at the door because science and faith don't mix. And, you know, here we are talking about scientific facts and how they relate to God's existence. But science and faith were not always in contention toward each other, right? I mean, it seems like nowadays, if you're going to be a scientist or a respected one, you can't be a Christian. And I'm wondering, what is going on there? How did Christianity somehow lose the connection with science?
Okay, well, I have a whole lot of responses to that statement, so let me just start at the beginning. Well, as I said before, and going through, you know, school and working in various industries and whatnot, I saw this kind of antagonism between science and faith. But I just always knew that there had to be a reconciliation. And the way I kind of look at it, and this is the way I kind of talk to my students about it, is I have kind of a triangle diagram, and on one side I have science, and the other side I have theology. And at the top of the apex, or the top of the triangle, I have truth. And I talk about how, you know, if we can just start with the notion that absolute truth exists, independent of our ability to attain it or understand it or comprehend it, if we can just start with the notion that absolute truth exists, we have to admit logically that those truths, whether about God or about nature, can't contradict each other.
Right.
Truths cannot contradict each other logically. So if we look at science and theology as our human ways of attaining or learning about the truth, on the one hand, science looks for truth about nature, theology looks for truth about God. And so if we look at those on each side of the triangle, kind of going up to that apex of truth, we kind of look at the idea that both science and theology kind of are iterative paths toward truth.
They're kind of studying the same thing from different perspectives.
Exactly. They're studying truth, and our paths as individuals and as a society kind of, you know, might take two steps forward and one step back and revise our understanding of truth about the subject matter.
Yeah, so it's a basic set of presuppositions, though, or basic ideas that you work with. It also includes a certain idea or theory of truth,
mm-hmm,
right?
Exactly.
And there are different competing theories of truth.
Exactly.
Maybe you could tell us what those are and why you think that the one that you have is the right one to use.
Okay, well, I think fundamentally I start with the scientific method.
Sure.
Okay, and the scientific method basically is looking for the best explanation to fit the evidence that we have so far.
Right.
Okay, so we're just looking for the best hypothesis or the best educated guess or the best tentative explanation of how all the facts fit together. And as I tell my students, when we're using the scientific method, good science holds on to what it calls truth fairly loosely because of the fact that new evidence could turn up tomorrow that would turn what we thought we knew on its head. Okay? And in a similar way, I think none of us could claim to have all of Christianity or God figured out yet.
Except for us at Apologetics.
Well, except for you guys.
We don't want to brag.
Exactly.
That's right.
But I go back to 1 Corinthians 13:12 that says, "Now we see through a glass darkly,
right?
But then we shall know as we are known. We'll see face to face." And
sure.
I mean, to me, I think that, you know, Paul's words describe our knowledge of God's creation as well as our understanding of who God is. And I think, you know, if we look at from the theological standpoint, Jesus himself was a paradigm shift.
Wow.
In the way that the Jews of that time understood God.
Yeah.
And so we can see paradigm shifts in our understanding of who God is too.
Right.
And so I think that where we see any kind of a conflict or a dissonance between science and theology, basically what we're looking at is a lack of full understanding or a lack of information. We don't have full knowledge. We don't have clear understanding.
Sure.
We don't have total comprehension and or interpretation of
now,
the facts.
All of this assumes a certain view of logic and its universality.
Exactly.
I mean, you already said that you kind of don't accept contradiction as being
right,
a valid
exactly.
way to look at the world.
Exactly.
And this also kind of implies a correspondence view of truth as
exactly.
opposed to some of the competing ideas that are coming from philosophy and sociology and such today.
Right, yeah. You can't get very far if you throw logic out the door.
Sure.
You know, I mean,
yeah, you can't just use it when it's convenient
right,
for your
exactly.
arguments.
I mean, exactly. I mean, if
I
you...
Do.
Yeah.
Well, that's another story.
You know, I was going to mention, too, that it's interesting you mentioned if things don't necessarily fit, you know, between science and faith, the reaction should not be that we should reject Christianity, but how about wait and see or study some more.
Yeah.
But it's,
right.
we're so quick in rejecting something just because we don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right, exactly. If there appears to be a conflict or a contradiction, then it to me it's simply that we don't have all the information and we're interpreting something badly.
Yeah. But isn't that also because, you know, in your background, you've known God for a long time. You've walked with God for a long time. You've dwelt in His Word. You've experienced your relationship with Him on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
And so you bring that to the table. It's not like you're really a blank slate just looking at barren facts out there in the universe.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, we all have our worldview glasses that we
sure.
look at things through. And
right.
But through that experience in my life of faith, if you will, I've seen God to be a God of order and reason.
Right.
And rationality. You know, one of my students actually just the other day said something like, well, you know, you talk about all these physical parameters being just exactly right and the physical laws and order and whatnot and the order that we have. Well, you know, God could have just made us so that we didn't need to follow any physical laws or everything could be chaotic. And I said, yeah, He could have, but He didn't.
You got to deal with the world you've got at
exactly,
the end of the day.
Exactly.
We talk a lot around here about the fact that, you know, we've got this world that we experience and these things that we find ourselves to be personal beings with certain innate truths that we have to grapple with, like right and wrong, good and evil, the universality of the laws of logic, mathematics. We've got all of these things, and we can't pretend that this isn't the world that we're in and that these aren't the people that we are. So when we come to, you know, try to deal with an idea like the existence of God and who we are in the universe that He's made, you know, that's what we've got to deal with. We can't deal with some hypothetical universe that doesn't exist or pretend that, you know, right and wrong, good and evil, truth and falsehood aren't here for us to grapple with. This is the one we've got to deal with. Does this one imply the existence of God? Well, of course it does. And maybe even asking the question presupposes in some ways the existence of God
mm-hmm.
and the universality of personality and logic and understanding and truth. You're listening to the Apologetics.com radio program. We're in the studio tonight with Leslie Wickman. How you doing, Leslie?
I'm good.
She's holding up just fine here on Apologetics.com. We've also got Harry Edwards, CEO of Apologetics.com here.
Hello, hello.
Lindsay Brooks is on the line with us. How's your phone bill doing, Lindsay?
You know, thank God I pay for so much.
And we've got Curtis Lee taking care of us in the sound booth, and we'll be right back.
The mission of Apologetics.com is to challenge believers to think and thinkers to believe on the radio, on the internet, and now in the Life of the Mind conferences. If you believe in the work that Apologetics.com is doing, we encourage you to support us with your prayers and also with your tax-deductible gift so that this ministry will continue on the air, on the web, and in events near you. Gifts of any amount are appreciated, and it's very simple to participate. Just go to Apologetics.com and click Donate. It's safe and secure. Or you can send your check or money order to Apologetics.com, 1900 Southwestern Avenue, San Pedro, California, 90732. Thank you for supporting Apologetics.com.
And thank you for listening to Apologetics.com. Glad to have you this morning. An interesting show, a really good show. I'll even go as far as to say a great show this morning. Christopher Nicewang is in studio. Lindsay Brooks on the phone. Harry's here. And our special guest, Leslie Wickman. She's an astronaut and a teacher and a professional football player. She's an incredible woman. She's interesting. You got to talk to her. Give us a call. 1-888-LA-TALKS. That's 1-888-528-2557. You're listening to Apologetics.com on 99.5 KKLA.
apologetics.com radio program, where we're challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe. We're in the studio tonight with Leslie Wickman. How you doing, Leslie?
I'm great, thanks.
How you holding up?
Oh, just fine.
It's different than you thought, huh?
Yeah, a lot.
It always is.
Hopefully good different.
We've got Lindsay on the phone. Well, how you doing, Lindsay?
Hey, pretty great.
All right. And so your daughter's up at Berkeley now?
Yeah, the big one's up in Berkeley. The little one's in bed in the other room.
Oh, yeah. And what's her major right now for the next 6 months?
Yeah, she's at the moment, she's really kind of undecided. So she's in arts and letters.
Oh.
But I'm seeing a couple of trends. One is law, and
she'd make a fine lawyer. She puts you in your place.
She does already. she has been since she was little, and the 7-year-old is already following in her sister's able footsteps in that regard. So I'm outclassed in my house, that's for sure.
Right. And so Harry, what's going on? What's going on with your kids?
Well, they are in bed right now.
Yeah.
Good.
As all people should be.
Yes. 8 and 5, they're doing well, they're healthy, so we are thankful.
Oh, that's a blessing. Now, when you were young, Leslie, what's your denominational background? How did you grow up?
Well, kind of as a Christian Protestant mutt, I guess. My parents were Lutheran, but we lived in a tiny little community on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State and went to the kind of one and only Protestant church there, which was Presbyterian.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a special grace. I'm just kidding. But did you learn the catechism and stuff like that?
At Presbyterian church?
Yeah. They have this little catechism called the Westminster Shorter Catechism, which just has basic questions and answers about the faith. And a lot of people grow up just learning it, so it's like a helpful tool for kids. So they.
I guess I missed out on that.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah.
So where do you go to church now?
I actually go to Ocean View Baptist Church in San Pedro.
Right.
Along with Harry.
Yep.
I have had the pleasure of visiting there with Harry, as a matter of fact, and you guys have got Dr. Richard Freeman. He's the pastor over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You got to speak there one time, remember?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess missed that
awesome
Sunday.
Obviously, they're still talking about it. I'm just kidding. And it's at 1900 Southwestern Avenue in San Pedro. And the telephone number is 310-833-4413. That's 310-833-4413. And the website address is www.ovb, and I guess that's for Ocean View Baptist Church. .org. So ovbchurch.org. And you guys recently had what, your 25-year anniversary, or was it 50?
I don't remember.
Sorry. Well, it was one or the other, and boy, was it great.
That's too bad.
Right now, the sermon series is on transformational thinking. That'll be on Sunday, September 28th, 2008. The things that Christians should focus on. And there's a lot of outreach at this church. There's a lot of involvement with the community. So it's a vibrant Christian community down there.
Definitely.
Church picnics this Sunday,
That's
too.
Right.
Wow. So free food, beat that.
There you go. That's a free plug for anyone in the area to come on by and check it out.
Yeah, and Leslie, don't you do something over there where you teach astronomy or something?
Well, something like that. Yeah. Basically, it's like astronomy for dummies.
That's the kind I need.
Joking. Dr. Freeman has been very gracious in allowing us to do a Sunday night event called Starry Nights Cafe.
Wow.
And the idea is doing some talks and discussions on how science and faith fit together for the layperson. So it's very exciting. And the name came from just my experience with astronomy students, taking them out on Starry Nights and just realizing that Starry Nights cause people to start asking the big questions about where all this came from and how long has it been here. And
see, that's great. That's a great way to approach it. That's really where the rubber hits the road, taking real-world questions and giving them real-world answers.
I know you do historical stuff, too, like the resurrection of Jesus, mm-hmm. Are the New Testament documents we have reliable, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so
are you for them or against them?
So it's a plug then. Once once we know when the next set of Starry Night lectures are going to take place, you will know from just us advertising it here on the air and also on the website, www.apologetics.com, and our church website, www.ovbchurch.org.
Got that right. Sounds pretty good. And we've got another call tonight. Greg, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
We're doing pretty good. You got a comment or a question for us?
Yeah, I've got a couple questions, actually. Based on what Leslie was speaking of concerning the strength of the gravitational force.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got my geology degree many years ago, so I'm probably going to ask kind of a stupid question.
No stupid questions.
But you were speaking of methane and ammonia
right.
not having a strong enough attraction.
Right.
Earth. Okay. And methane is what, a molecular weight of about 15?
Methane is 16 grams per mole, and ammonia is 17 grams per mole.
Okay. Ammonia is 17. Okay. And an oxygen molecule is 16, right?
Right. Well, an oxygen atom is 16. Atomic oxygen.
Okay. Is
a single. So an oxygen molecule, since it's diatomic, would be
32.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is a good thing, too, because if it was, you know, if we were relying on atomic oxygen, we wouldn't have
right.
much of that either. But you do find it out in low Earth orbit where some of the spacecraft are, because it, you know, basically floats to the top of the atmosphere.
Right. Okay. Now, thank you for reminding about the monoatomic weight of 16. So, If methane and ammonia tend to leave the Earth's atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
what does that do for the theory that a lot of the evolutionary biologists have, which is that they required a whole lot of methane and ammonia for their primordial soup?
Well, actually, yeah, that's an interesting question. More and more evolutionary biologists are saying flat out that the conditions on early Earth were not conducive to life, and there was no primordial soup. There certainly was more methane in Earth's early atmosphere, but that was during the formation process, before the Earth really was in the shape that we have it today. And as the Earth coalesced and warmed, the gravitational is a combination of the gravity and the temperature that makes the atmosphere not conducive to holding on to methane. So if you have a warmer atmosphere, the lighter gases are going to escape also. So it's a combination of the gravity is too low and the atmosphere is too warm to hold on to much methane.
Well,
okay.
See, that brings me to a question. It's a scientific question that's always bothered me. What weighs more, a ton of feathers or a ton of bricks?
I'll let you take that one.
That doesn't
Greg.
Bother anybody else. Thank you so much for your call, Greg. We appreciate it. Next on the line, we've got Michael.
Hello, good evening.
Hey, good evening. How you doing?
Good, good. Excellent program.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. God bless. I came up with, as you mentioned, methane. I saw a program on, Nightline talk about how cows with methane is damaging the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those cows are at it again.
So, anyway, maybe later on, if you have a chance, maybe you could touch on global warming, but my question is different. My question is basically the phrase young Earth and old Earth, and the fact that just this week, John MacArthur, the pastor, he's going to Genesis 1, and he basically believe in the sixth literal day of creation. And one of the things he said that's interesting is that God created everything like old, like aged. For instance, Adam and Eve wasn't born a babe, and the whales and everything was born basically adult. So it's difficult to you know, judge the age of the earth. So I would like you to comment on that, like young earth, old Earth and what John MacArthur said, for instance.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I could listen off the ear. God bless you.
Sure.
And excellent program.
Sure.
Okay, bye.
Okay. Do you want me to address that?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think the most important thing to remember is that whether the Earth is young or old, it's not a fundamental, foundational question for our faith. And so I think the last thing we want to do is argue about it and make it divisive. Secondly, I think one of the things that is important to note from the scripture passages in Genesis that the word that's used or translated in our Bibles as day is the Hebrew word yom, that can be literally translated as a 24-hour day or an era or an indefinite period of time. So all those translations of the word yom are equally literal. And as we do, even in our English language, use the word day for various meanings. For example, we say back in the day or in that day or whatever. We're referring to an era as opposed to necessarily a 24-hour period. So I don't think we should get hung up on that translation of the word yom as meaning a literal 24-hour period. And then the other thing that I talk to my students about in class is just that the idea that in using the scientific method, what we want to do is look for the explanation that best fits the evidence. And so, you know, far be it from any of us to say this is how God did it. God could have done it any way he wanted to, but none of us were there. And so I think it's really important for us to maintain an attitude of humility about it because none of us know. None of us were there. And it's just, you know, it's something that's interesting to investigate and try to see where the best evidence is. And I guess I've probably said about enough.
Well, that's great, though. And we're talking about the relationship between science and faith, between faith and reason. We've got our astronaut here, rocket scientist Leslie Wickman on the air with us tonight. Also, Harry Edwards and Lindsay Brooks is on the line. And what I want to do now is just put forward some ideas, you know, just basically some words, and you can give commentary on what you think about the subject.
Okay.
Because all of the questions are kind of implied. Okay. Here's the first one. Aliens.
That's a question?
You can't be an astronaut and not have some, you know, opinions on
all
the aliens.
Right. Okay, well, I'll start that out.
We won't go with Scientology. It'll just be straight alien talk.
Well, I'd like to begin that that topic by saying that my cat's name is Mulder.
That's awesome. The truth is out there.
The truth is out there. Yeah. Anyway, okay, so aliens. Again, you know, Scripture doesn't tell us whether God created other intelligent beings or not, or life elsewhere in the universe. And so we don't really know. But I think maybe one of the important things to remember is just how far away any other star system, let alone Earth-like planet, is. For example, the closest star system to us is 4.3 light years away.
Hmm.
And so far as we know, there aren't any Earth-like extrasolar planets there. So we have to look even farther than that to come to the first Earth-like extrasolar planet. And with our methods of space travel at this stage, we can't even travel at 1/100th of the speed of light. So if you imagine,
wow,
let's just say that we could travel at 1/100th of the speed of light, it would take 4,300 years just to get to that next star system.
Hmm.
So the travel between these destinations that we're talking about, it would just be, as far as, you know, we know, insurmountable of a problem technologically at this point. And people start talking about, well, what about wormholes? What about warp drive and all this sort of thing, which is pretty much science fiction at this point. And also just in terms of the development of any other civilization, we've had a limited amount of time for the universe to get to a stage, or for there to be star systems that are would be habitable with extrasolar planets. So any other civilization is not likely to be, quote-unquote, light years ahead of us.
Now, here's something about that. Some very famous scientists, philosophers, and, you know, atheists, like Francis Crick, Fred Hoyle, and even Richard Dawkins, have recently said that they don't have such a hard time with the idea of intelligent design per se, and they've even admitted that possibly, you know, human beings and life on this planet was seeded or begun by alien life forms or more intelligent life forms from somewhere else. So how do you respond to that?
Okay, that's the panspermia or transpermia theory, is that because of the fact that it's pretty generally acknowledged that the conditions on early Earth were not conducive to life spontaneously occurring here, that life came from someplace else.
Sure.
And actually, there was a recent experiment that was done, I believe it was by some, I think it was by the Russian space program, where they actually simulated using a rock that was meteor-like, and it had some fossils and some carbonaceous compounds on it, and basically painted it with some bacteria and sent it into space. And when it came back, all the bacteria were dead. So,
which you would kind of expect. It's tough out there.
It's a tough environment out in space, exactly. It would be very hard for something like that to survive, even a short trip in space, let alone a very long one.
Wow.
Our little garden planet, our little oasis in space, is really quite an amazingly isolated thing when you think about how far things really are and all of that.
How cold and hot it is.
Right, exactly.
Extremes of everything.
I mean,
so,
go ahead, sorry.
Is Mars, I mean, back to my Mars question, because I'm getting impatient.
Okay, yeah. sorry.
You know, is there life on Mars, and is it extreme, is it extreme enough to preclude life? You know, if somebody told me that there were, you know, microbes in ice water or something up there, is any of that, like, true?
No, nothing has been observed at all as far as any traces of past life on Mars. And the thing is, if you kind of look just at the solar system and parameters within the solar system, if you look at Venus, for example, Venus is a little bit closer to the sun and almost the same size, just slightly smaller than the Earth mass-wise. Venus, being closer to the sun, has... well, and also its atmosphere isn't right. Its atmosphere is very dense CO2, carbon dioxide, 90 times the atmospheric pressure that we have here on Earth, so essentially be crushed at the surface. It has clouds that are laced with sulfuric acid, so it's not very friendly.
Yeah, that's bad.
And the surface temperature is about 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, so not very... hospitable to life whatsoever.
Once you get past, like, 750 degrees.
Okay.
I learned that by watching the $6 Million Man when the Venus probe came back. You remember that?
That's right.
No, but that
is that the one
cool.
with Bigfoot?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
They were aliens, right? And Bigfoot was a big robot?
The science there, we do learn from television programs and things, and it's really hard to sort of parse out what's
real.
That's why we're
not.
The informed people that we are, Lindsay.
Exactly. But Schoolhouse Rock.
So I don't know if you want to go out the other direction towards Mars, but
right.
when you get a little bit farther away, of course, you get a little bit farther away from the sun, you get colder. And so Mars is quite cold, but even possibly more problematic than the temperature is the fact that Mars is much smaller than the Earth, and its gravity is only 3/8 of what Earth's gravity is. So remember, we were talking about the different gases that Earth is capable of holding on to and not capable of holding on to. Well, the most important of which, of course, is water vapor at 18 grams per mole, and Earth's gravity is just barely strong enough to hold on to water vapor in large quantities, which is a really lucky thing, or providential, however you look at it. And if Mars's gravity is only 3/8 of Earth's gravity, it doesn't really take a rocket scientist to figure out that.
Sometimes it does.
That Mars's gravity is too weak to hold on to water vapor, and therefore you can't have a water cycle on Mars, which is necessary for life. So yeah, you basically all the water on Mars exists in a frozen form because, you know, as when water ice freezes, it goes into a crystalline structure, and so the molecules are held to each other as well as to whatever it's frozen next to, like the ground. But as soon as that were to evaporate, first of all, the atmospheric pressure is so low, it's only 1/100th of the Earth's atmospheric pressure, so the water would immediately evaporate, and then once it became water vapor, it would escape from the Earth, Mars's gravity. So
Mars rover, big waste of my tax dollars.
Okay, and this, you know, this is one of my fun things to talk about. But yeah. If the whole deal is, you know, okay, you look at the other planets in the solar system, and it just gets worse. Okay?
Yeah.
Mars is the one that's
the closest,
least hostile to life other than Earth. Everything else is much, much worse. So that's kind of...
What do you think, Lindsay?
Well, either there's some other formulation of life that is somehow or another able to deal with conditions. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I used to, you know, read a lot of science fiction, and they talked about, you know, what other kinds of life might look like. You know, silicone-based life, or, you know, you watch Star Trek and there was life that was gaseous and all this, like...
Yeah, remember the big rock alien thing that ate through... Anyway, that's a different thing. But isn't it funny, though, that people think that they want to come here, though? Like, yeah, say you've got something that's so weird it can, like, survive on Jupiter, and it really wants to get to here so it can, what, go to McDonald's? I don't know.
So it can die on our surface.
So it can die in anguish and pain on the surface of the Earth.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, basically, from my perspective, I really see that, you know, unless there are parameters for life that are outside of what we understand life to be, you know, it just seems like it's so hugely not possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even
I'm not a mathematician. I can't figure out the odds on this the way people like to do. We like to figure odds on, mm-hmm. you know, on this type of thing. But I just can't even imagine how astronomical the odds against this would be. And you know, you hear, I remember the movie Contact,
mm-hmm.
based on Sagan's book, where they had the SETI, the SETI array looking out into space for signs of intelligent life, and at the end, the big point was, well, with all that space out there, it sure would be a waste of space if there was no one else here.
Yeah.
You know, and I kept thinking to myself, well, not really.
No, not really.
That's how much space it takes for life here.
Yeah, how much room does it take?
Well,
I don't know, but you're listening to the Apologetics.com radio program, and we have our special guest,
Leslie Wickman.
I keep wanting to say Lindsay because I'm talking to Lindsay, and I'm like, it's not Lindsay Wickman.
My niece's name is Lindsay Wickman.
So maybe we could talk to Lindsay Wickman if we want to wake her up in the middle of the night, but you're listening to the Apologetics.com radio program, and we'll be right back.
And welcome back. It's Apologetics.com on 99.5 KKLA. Thank you so much for listening. You've always wanted to meet a rocket scientist. Well, we have one right here in our studio this morning. And we'd love to hear from you. So give us a call. The telephone number is 1-888-LA-TALKS. That's 1-888-528-2557. And you can meet a real rocket scientist. She's here in studio. Christopher Nicewanger is here as well. We have Harry Edwards. And Lindsay Brooks is on the telephone. So give us a call. We're waiting to hear from you. You can hit us up on the internet as well. And that address is radio@apologetics.com. It's apologetics.com on 99.5 KKLA. Thank you.
Curtis, what is that?
That does
We're
not
having a debate in here about whether that does not compute Will Robinson, see?
That's right. That was the theme to Lost in Space.
Oh, see?
I'm aging myself with that one.
It was amazing.
My favorite
Did you ever watch
show.
That as a kid?
Reruns.
Oh, yeah. Good show.
Dude, you were always lost on a different planet with something trying to eat you, and the robot always had to come and save you.
Yeah.
They tried to do a remake of it in a movie a few years ago.
And it was horrible.
I'm sorry. We won't bring that up. It was a very unfortunate time in what's his name from Friends?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That guy.
That's why he's called What's His Name from Friends, right there.
What is his
That's
name?
That's right.
Matt Damon.
LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc.
Yeah.
So tonight on Apologetics.com, we have our special guest, Leslie Wickman. Not
Hi.
To be confused with our special staff, Lindsay Brooks.
Hey, yeah. Hey, y'all.
And Harry Edwards. It's our special pleasure to have you in the studio tonight, Harry, the CEO of Apologetics.com.
Thanks for having me.
How long have you been doing Apologetics.com?
Since 89.
So you actually formed this as a ministry?
Yes.
This is kind of your baby.
Sort
Very
of.
Close to your heart, huh?
Yes. Started out as a school project. And,
wow.
I figured that if I was going to spend some time doing anything, that it would someday outlive me.
So, wow.
So that's the whole idea
and
behind
has it?
It. Not yet.
No, okay.
Thankfully.
Sorry.
Thankfully, yeah.
I'm getting ahead of myself. But, so you've got this radio ministry, this Apologetics.com radio show that we do. What else does Apologetics.com do?
Well, we're very involved on the Internet. That's where our ministry name comes from. And we have a speakers bureau we call Culture Talk. And we have a lively discussion board, which Lindsay actually moderates. And it's kind of special because we don't just let anybody in there. You kind of have to be a nice, thoughtful, respectful person if you're going to hang around our discussion boards. Let's see what else.
As Lindsay always is.
Yes, yes.
We
like
very
doing
cultured,
mission trips.
And Lindsay's very
well.
Cultured. He's very inviting.
You guys actually let me moderate the board. It's really an amazing thing. You know, given my propensity to be a little acrid sometimes.
Well, none of us have ever seen it, Lindsay. But we assume that you're very good, that you're really good.
And by the way, that's how we met, Lindsay.
Just kidding.
Remember, Lindsay? That's how we met you.
That's exactly
Yeah,
true.
Lindsay was on. Lindsay was on the boards, and he was writing things that were very thoughtful. He obviously showed a background in Christian doctrine, Christian history, Christian other things that I can't think of right now, but they were all there, whatever they were.
History, language.
And I think we had you in on a show on, what was it, on music or something like that?
Aesthetics.
Yeah, that's kind of my thing.
And we were just like, wow, this guy is actually odd enough that we could work together.
Theo geek.
Theo geeks unite.
Yeah.
You know, why is it that I picked the night that the boss is coming down to the studio? What is that?
It was all arranged. Anyway, we've got a call by Pastor Richard on Apologetics.com.
Hi, blessings in the name of the Lord. I just, you're keeping me up tonight. It's a wonderful topic.
Oh, but, great. Well, thank you for calling in.
Amen. The Bible says that the heavens speak of the glory of God, and one question I've got is, how the scientific community deals with the idea of an infinite space, the fact that it literally goes on forever. It doesn't make sense to the logical mind. How do you rationalize that? How does the scientific mind rationalize that?
Well, actually, the space-time continuum doesn't go on forever, according to Einstein's relativity, and actually from what we know about Big Bang dynamics and the expansion of the universe, the space-time continuum is being stretched out. And in fact, that's kind of an interesting reference to various Old Testament scriptures that speak about God stretching out the heavens. Which I love. I mean, just the idea that, you know, back then, you know, whether the writers actually knew what they were writing about, it clearly is inspired to me, the fact that, you know, these Old Testament writers talked about God stretching out the heavens like a tent. And the fact is that, you know, here we are thousands of years later actually learning from science that is exactly what's happening, is the heavens are being stretched out, and not just the stars and galaxies and everything in it, but the space-time continuum itself is being stretched out like a tent. And one interesting thing that I just want to comment on is that the idea of the Big Bang is very widely accepted throughout the astronomical community, and the Big Bang creation event really does beg the question of, well, if there's a beginning, there had to be a beginner, and just by simple logic, cause and effect, that any effect needs to have a cause outside of itself. And so that in itself is causing many astrophysicists and astronomers to ask the question of who that beginner is, who that, what that primary cause, that Aristotle's unmoved mover, who is that? And so throughout the astronomical community, in fact, it's very hard to talk about the anthropic principle or the Big Bang creation event or anything without really talking about an intelligence or some creative force behind all this.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
If you sent a rocket straight up for eternity, would it not potentially go beyond the space-time continuum? Could that not be? I mean, there is a space-time continuum, but there is space. I mean, if you send a rocket up and it goes for eternity, eventually it's going to go, would it not go beyond the space-time continuum somehow? Or?
Well, actually, no. I mean, it's kind of, you know, because of the fact that we are three-dimensional beings, we think in three dimensions of physical space, and but the fact of it, the matter, at least from the way we understand things now, is that space itself is being stretched out, and that there's not space beyond that. There's not space beyond the edge of the universe. We don't know what's beyond the edge of the universe, yeah. But it's not space as we know it anyway.
Not a brick wall for sure. Whatever it is, it's taking up space though. Not in the way that
we understand.
I think that Pastor Richard is talking about theoretical space, or in our understanding of three dimensionality, you necessarily have to posit something that may not be there in actual physical reality, and that's part of the problem in dealing with things that have to do with the nature of the universe. We only can observe the observable universe, kind of by definition.
Right.
You know, if things either don't emit light or they're moving faster than the speed of light, we can't observe them at all. We can only posit their possible existence. But kind of by definition, there is no space or time beyond the observable universe for all intents and purposes of doing the sciences.
Is it not?
I know it's weird.
Is it not at all possible that the book of Isaiah is correct when says that, you know, God says, my ways, mm-hmm. as high as the heavens are above, you know, the earth, so are my ways above yours, mm-hmm. that it's simply beyond our human understanding, and that perhaps we may not know the answer to this till we...
Absolutely.
Till we get to that. I mean, we have a limit to our, rather finite, you know, limit to our, we're very finite in terms of our ability to understand the
exactly.
things of God. I think if we could understand that, perhaps we would be God. I mean, am I out of time here? Or do I have time for another question?
You have time for another question.
Can I just respond though with one scripture verse that I like? Actually, I used this earlier, 1 Corinthians 13:12, that says, now we see through a glass darkly, and then we shall see face to face and be known. And I think that, you know, that applies to our understanding of God as well as God's creation. And that, you know, we need to maintain an attitude of humility because we don't know. You know, God knows. We don't know. We're just kind of exploring what he's created and seeing amazing evidences for his hand.
Yeah, and with that, Pastor, there's always that thing of, even though we can't really understand things exactly the way that God does, especially quantitatively, there are all kinds of things that he has told us and given us the ability to understand in some measure. So that's really what we're talking about here, is just the things that he's given us that we can understand.
Sure, absolutely. God gives us enough light to mm-hmm. make it really exciting.
Yeah.
And I just one more thing I was going to say, that what scientific formula is it? Anything, if I'm talking about the infinite complexity, seemingly, of this world, the way it's it's put together. So it's like a trillion fine-tuned Swiss watches. It's just remarkable.
Right.
The symbiotic relationships between everything. And for any scientist to posit that this just happened, you know, from a lightning strike on some primordial ooze, you know, billions of years ago, that literally seems insane to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand why a scientist, if his whole world is locked up in what he can see and feel and hear and touch, I sort of understand what they're saying. But once you meet Jesus, things change.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the scientific mathematical model?
Yeah.
Anything coming into existence that, if the chances of something coming into existence are beyond, what is it, 10 to the 16th power?
10 to the
it is no longer, you know, a chance. I mean, it had to be planned.
It's a statistical principle. Most statisticians say that once something reaches beyond the odds of 1 in 10 to the 50th power, it goes from being statistically improbable to virtually impossible for it to happen.
If I'm not mistaken, certain scientists within the secular realm have determined that the odds of this world coming into existence under happenstance are beyond that, I believe.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier about the anthropic principle.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on whose list you look at, some of the lists are over 300 parameters long, and if you look at the odds for all of those 300 plus parameters falling within the very fine narrow range of values that they need to in order for life to exist anywhere in the universe, you can calculate odds of 1 chance in 10 to the 282nd power or so, which is kind of like the same odds as one person buying one lottery ticket each time for one drawing and winning 2 times a week every single week for 50 years in a row off of one ticket for each drawing. So, I mean, just to put that into kind of some perspective.
Some context there. I heard one scientist say, who was an atheist, he said that when he really took a look at the universe and he...
Oh, I'm sorry, Pastor. I think we lost you there. Hello, is someone else on the air?
Hello, yes, this is Mick from Torrance.
How are you doing, Mick?
Good, how are you doing?
You have a comment or a question for
guest? I have a question for Leslie One and then possibly the entire group. I just, this little bit more like theoretical, not technical, or what is the current status of the scientific community as far as including God and His Word and having a Christian worldview? Are there... a lot? Is that growing? Is it going to take a long time? Do we, you know, need a lot of work in that area? That's one question. And then the second question for everyone, and then I'll go ahead and take it off the air, is, you know, it seemed to be that the church, maybe the turn of the century or before that, I'm talking about early 1900s, was more than happy to relinquish God in the sciences, or God in government, or God in law, and just so they could hold on to man and salvation and stuff. But I kind of think there's been a resurgence of God being involved, sovereign over all areas of life. What's it going to take to bring that back? Because I think that was in the sciences, and that was in the culture, you know, during the 1600s and maybe even the 1700s. So those are my two questions. What's going on in the scientific community, and how can, you know, we instruct our people that God is involved in all areas of life? Does that make sense?
I think it's a great question.
Maybe, Lindsay, I haven't heard him for a while. What a show you have, like, 2001, A Space Odyssey. I want to say, hi, I'm Hal 9000. And then you have, like, death metal, then you have Lost in Space.
It's
a good plane, but...
At the end of the day, all music is heavy metal, Mick.
Yeah, okay.
It really is. Especially Scottish dance music.
All right, I'll take it off the air.
Thank you so much for your call.
Sure thing.
Okay, well, I guess to start with his first question, I see more and more scientists, especially in the physical sciences and astronomy and astrophysics, who just, I mean, the evidence is just overwhelming in terms of, you know, like, again, going back to the anthropic principle and how all these values have to be just exactly right in order to have life anywhere in the universe. In fact, one of my friends, Hugh Ross, who I think has been on this program before,
sure.
With Reasons to Believe, has said that when they're looking for an atheist for a college campus debate, they have to look outside of the physical sciences because all the physical scientists are believers, which
wow.
may be an overstatement, but
sure, but it's still
least,
a dramatic.
Well, yeah, and I mean even
fact.
Even yeah. Einstein made all kinds of comments about, you know, science without religion is lame and religion without science is blind. I might have had that backwards, but you know, and I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details, and you know, we wouldn't. Einstein was a deist rather than a theist, but there are many, many, many scientists within the astronomical community who would have similar sentiments, at least.
Right.
And I think, you know, in the life sciences, you look at people like Francis Collins, who is the leader of the Human
sure.
Genome Project and a devout evangelical Christian.
Hmm.
And, you know, I mean, it's just hard to look at all this complexity and information and everything being just exactly right and then turn around and say that it all happened just randomly. It's just it really, I mean, you look at the odds of, again, the anthropic principle, and then you ask, you know, well, what takes more faith? Does it take more faith to believe that God created a creative force outside of the universe?
Right.
A cause outside of the universe created all this? Or does it take more faith to believe that it just happened randomly by chance, defying all odds?
I think it takes a lot of psychological force to deny so much of what we are mm-hmm. and so much of what we seem to be.
Right.
Our personality, our logic, our ability to understand, our will, our ability to choose things, our ability to discern between right and wrong actions and their consequences,
right.
and to continually try to swallow that down so that you can reduce everything to the random consequences of atoms in motion.
Yeah.
There's a massive kind of self-denial mm-hmm. that seems to go into that.
And just one other comment as far as the kind of birthplace of science within Christendom back during the time of the Renaissance. And
sure.
I mean, many people would actually trace the scientific method back to the Christian worldview, and there are various scriptures that talk about, you know, test everything, hold on to the good in Thessalonians, and taste and see that the Lord is good, and just encouraging us to experience God's creation and check it out for ourselves. And I think that's, you know, in large part why science grew in
right.
a Christian environment with a Christian worldview.
Yeah, and from that, so many people are having success with the sciences as long as they, in a sense, include aspects of a Christian worldview that might be inconsistent with their own.
Mm-hmm.
How do people get by doing that? Well, like, you know, assuming that the laws of logic are universal and
right.
that there's a uniformity to nature and
right.
things like that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you can't look at nature without seeing this amazing order.
Hmm.
And I mean, even when you look at, we talked about the multiverse hypothesis earlier, that, you know, perhaps there are an infinite number of inaccessible universes that we will never be able to investigate, but maybe they're out there, and that, you know, ours is just the one that happened to get all these parameters just exactly right. Well, okay, if that's the case, it still relies on this concept of order.
Right.
In order for there to be parameters to have values, there have to be physical laws and order that we're assuming in these other universes to even have placeholders for those values.
Yeah, and that earlier caller, Mick, actually brought up the idea of worldviews, and it
mm-hmm.
seems like a lot of worldviews can be separated just on the basis of that their ultimate principle is order, or their ultimate principle is chaos.
Right, exactly. Or that the world is an illusion, that the physical mm-hmm. world is simply an illusion, so
sure.
it's why test it?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
So which one is ours? Order or chaos?
I like to think order.
It's order.
There are a lot of things in the scientific community that they must assume for science to work. You know, like you mentioned, uniformity of nature. Like when they wake up tomorrow, they can count on gravity still working. All those kinds of things.
Right, repeatability. Yeah. Repeatability of experiments. You have to be able to repeat an experiment and expect that the laws of physics are going to work the same today as they did yesterday.
And in those worldviews that are rooted in chaos or ultimate inexplicability and non-reason, how could you actually get a scientific mode of understanding or being able to investigate the universe from that?
It's hard to even imagine being motivated to investigate with a worldview that is.
Well, I do hear about a lot of scientists that are very interested in Eastern religion, which seems to have sometimes those kind of qualities to their thinking, and yet they are motivated in the sciences.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you.
Well, that's why we end up having theories like crystals on the back of
life forming by worms.
Yeah. Or
by
know,
molecules piggybacking on the back of crystals. Yeah, that was from Ben Stein's movie, one of the questions that he asked one of the famous atheists.
Okay, well, another one that comes out of that kind of Eastern worldview is the cyclical universe. Mm-hmm. And we know now, I mean, for a long time people talked about, you know, are we going to end up in a big crunch? Is the universe oscillating? Maybe it's just going from, you know, a singularity to this expansion to a big crunch and starting over again. Well, we know now that the expansion rate is actually not just not slowing down, but it's accelerating. So it's going faster and faster. So the faster everything moves apart from everything else, the less chance we have of gravity bringing it back together, and we're past that point now. So we know that that worldview just doesn't hold up.
Yeah, anyway. Poor Nietzsche. One more slam on Nietzsche. But in that, you know, even meaning, when we get to the idea of meaning, there are certain worldviews that seem to be capable of providing a human being with meaning for their actions and for their lives and for the things that happen to them, and other worldviews that don't. How do you explain that?
Well, I believe that, you know, God is the creator. Well, certainly, and it's interesting because even secular scientists have commented on the fact that the universe is not just barely bio-friendly, if you will, but it's extravagantly bio-friendly. It's not designed so that we can just barely exist, but that we can exist and thrive and have an intelligence that allows us to ask these questions about meaning and purpose.
Right.
You know, and so, wow. I mean, Pascal, you know, the great mathematician, said that, you know, we all have a God-shaped vacuum inside ourselves, and we're searching for that one thing that can fill us, and that's a relationship with God. Mm. And so I believe that God designed within us a desire to know him and to have purpose.
Now, in that need to understand yourself in the context of God and his existence, you are specifically a Christian. Mm-hmm. And why a Christian instead of some other way of approaching God?
Well, to be honest, obviously, I grew up in a Christian home, and so that would be the tendency that I would have been trained in. But once I got to college, I started kind of, as many people do in college, kind of stepping back and saying, does my worldview make sense?
Sure.
And so I asked a lot of hard questions, and it fits. Mm. My Christian worldview fits with the scientific evidence. And to me, it fits better than any other worldview.
Right.
And because of that coherence, again, as I said before, I believe in logic. And I believe that if absolute truth exists, then one truth can't contradict another. And so, to me, the truth of Christianity, and that I learned from Scripture and from the witness of the Holy Spirit, as well as, you know, what Galileo called God's other book, creation or nature, all cohere, come together, and support each other in that one truth. And, you know, That's why, to me, the Christian worldview works.
Now, you teach specifically at a Christian university.
Yes.
Why have you chosen to do that when obviously you could have taught somewhere else?
Well, quite honestly, it it is because I have the ability to address these questions of science and faith.
Wow.
Whereas at a secular institution, I'd be much more limited.
Right. And you've been listening tonight to Leslie Wickman, astronaut, professional football player, thinker extraordinaire, educator, rocket scientist, fighter pilot proficiency expert for the RAND Corporation, Fulbright Senior Fellowship Scholar for water reclamation on the moon. As if that wasn't enough.
We didn't get to the Bellagio one. So, yeah.
I've got a subscription to Scientific American.
Cool.
Thanks. And it's been great to have you here. We really appreciate you coming down.
My pleasure.
Hopefully you'll come back again sometime. Harry Edwards, CEO of Apologetics.com, thank you so much for being here.
Good night,
it's
everyone.
It's been fun to have you. So it's tough. Yeah. Congratulations.
Where is
the
it?
The award.
Show me the award.
Well, it's financial. Harry, if you could give her $5 for, yeah.
For parking.
Sure. Lindsay, are you still there? Lindsay fought the good fight, but I think, you know, he finally, you know,
succumbed.
Went to bed.
Okay.
And Curtis, thank you so much for all of your help tonight and getting us such great music. We really appreciate it. This is Christopher Niswonger, and you've been listening to the Apologetics.com radio program, and we'll be back next week. Make sure you visit Ocean View Baptist Church in San Pedro and the Apologetics.com website.